Welcome to the Gallery of Readers podcast. Today we will be hearing from Suzanne Smith. In one half of her life, Suzanne works for the Department of Higher Education as the Director of Research, doing the science to help social equity projects happen. Then the cape comes off and she writes beautiful, heartfelt pieces about ancestry, friendship, time, and relationship. A few of them do have mature themes. I'm Larkin, and Gallery of Readers is a nonprofit small press that organizes a reading series every year and has published 21 books by local authors. For those books, free poems, event information, and more, visit us at galleryofreaders.org. Thank you so much for being here today, Suzanne.
Thank you for having me.
Suzanne, who are your favorite authors?
Okay, well, one of my most favorite authors is John McPhee. I'm a really big fan of creative nonfiction, all kinds of nonfiction, and he's one of the authors that I think most, you know, I get most absorbed in. I love reading about science and how things are made and how things work, surprisingly. And so I'm a very big fan of his. And I'm also a fan of Garcia Marquez. I don't read a lot of fiction because I feel like I need to be on a really extended vacation in order to really... I'm very impressionable, and I get very involved in fiction, and it's hard to pull my head out, but he has been one of my favorites since I was, you know, maybe 18.
I feel like I can hear that in your writing. There's a quality of it that's very immersive.
Oh, interesting.
The world is very sensitive. How do you write things?
You know, I think I just go. I think that I use my hand. And I use a pen, and I prefer that to writing on a computer. There's something that is released when I start going with that pen. I write at specific times, and when I'm not writing, I'm not writing. But I'm thinking a lot.
Where does your writing come from, and specifically what you're reading today?
So I think this particular reading and a lot of my writing in general comes from probably a lifetime of an inattention to relationships. I think in my regular life, I didn't really think that the way relationships worked were that important or worthy of my attention. I didn't actively think that, but I didn't pay a lot of attention to them until I think later on in life. And I realized that it's something I deeply care about is how relationships work, how nuanced they can be, the conflict, how it's overcome. I realized it was way more fascinating and important to me than I ever thought.
Wow.
And there's also something about loss. And as I get into my empty nest years, I would say, I feel like sometimes I call it the karma years, but, you know, we're saying goodbye to a lot. We're saying goodbye to a lot of people we knew. We're saying goodbye to pets, and we're saying goodbye to children that we knew because they've grown. And maybe even to the life that we thought we were going to have. And I find myself confronted with having to realize, oh, that's what this was like for them. And having to think about, you know, how other people have experienced their lives. And so a lot of people that I wish I knew more about what their lives were like. My ancestors, my grandparents, they're gone and I can't ask. Mm-hmm. And even friends that I've lost, I can't ask the questions. And so I'm sort of left to wonder. And in my writing, I think I try and figure things out.
Wow. What a beautiful sensitivity. Do you ever have block? And do you have any good solves for it? Or is there a writing prompt that you particularly like?
It's a great question. I do have block. And sometimes I'll just write nonsense until something comes to me. Ooh. I think I must have learned that in college, you know, free writing exercises or something. But one of my favorite prompts is when writing with others and there's something that leads people to throw words into the room. And there's some kind of wordplay and it may be some free association. And I find that usually if I take off with something like that, with some free association, with something, you could say sewing machine and peach, and somehow I'm going to eventually, if I keep writing, I'm going to get to whatever's going on that I'm trying to figure out. And I may avoid it a little bit, but I'm going to get there through probably many different doors.
Wow, that's lovely. Is there anything you'd like to brag about?
Well, yes. I mean, I'm very proud of this, my little chapbook. It's called Ag and Gunner. And I love the way that it came together. I love that I finally had the courage to be seen and heard with my writing because writing has always been something that felt like, even if it was a scholarly paper I had to write, it felt very much like my heart is on my sleeve. It could have been a science paper. And so I feel very proud and relieved to feel that I actually can share it.
Wow. Thank you for that courage. Who do you imagine as the audience for your writing?
I think that often I'm imagining the audience is someone who is going to be born later. Much later. This often is what comes into my head. I'm telling how it was, and maybe I'm doing that because those are the questions I want to ask of people from long ago that I can't get an answer to. I want to know what was it like. And so I think that I'm often imagining maybe it's a great grandchild, or maybe it's just someone who picks something up, finds it in an attic. That's what I imagine, and maybe understand something about how it felt.
Wow. Thank you so much.
So this is an excerpt from the first piece in the chapbook, which is called House. I see the light and the shadows of the cars going by on the ceiling of our grandmother's bedroom while I lie in her bed. My sister, Lainey, is in our grandfather's bed, which is separate and twin. I lie there and I cry. When she asks me what is wrong, I say it. I say it out loud, a fact that I have observed that day. An unmistakable, heartbreaking fact. I say, Grandmother doesn't love Grandfather. Grandfather is the sweetest of men. He took me to see Pippi Longstocking just because I called and asked, and he let me drive the mail truck while I sat on his lap. Sometimes, when I come over, he shakes my hand, slips me a dollar bill, and says, Go buy yourself an ice cream. And sometimes, we take an old loaf of bread and feed the ducks at the pond in Winchester Center. I don't mind that he doesn't like that John Elton, as he calls him, because he walks with me to the little store to buy milk and a newspaper, and he teaches me how to let the waves come in over my feet, burying them with sand as I stand, perfectly still, just like him, with my hands clasped behind my back. The trick is not to move our feet or wiggle our toes, or we'll have to start all over again. Later in the afternoon, we take a slow walk to the jetty looking for shells, and if we're lucky, we find a sand dollar. But grandmother yells at him, says, "You're going to the moon," whenever he has an idea or tries to express an opinion. Sometimes, though, when she's not looking, he sneaks 3 extra cookies with a simple trick that he thinks she doesn't know about. First, he puts 1 cookie between his thumb and forefinger. Next, he tucks 3 more between the curl of his remaining fingers and his palm. Then, he makes the 1 cookie obvious. Holding up his hand a bit to display this cookie, he walks out of the kitchen, goes into the sun parlor, sits down in front of the ball game, and enjoys his 4 cookies in peace. I asked my grandmother one time, "Why do you call him Gunner?" "Well," she said, "whenever I'd ask him to do something around the house, he'd say, 'I'm gonna, I'm gonna.'" As I relate this later at a funeral or wake, someone laughs, "Yeah, I guess grandfather never really did much around the house." Wait, what do you mean? My mind flashes on so many images of grandfather fixing the back steps, planting his garden, rescuing that old-fashioned child's desk from the nearby elementary school when it closed. He had sanded and stained it for me and my sister, and then painted our names on the back in red. I still have it, our names in his handwriting. My sister said it was fine if I kept it. I told her we could take turns. Along with these flashes come grandmother's criticisms. I say out loud, "I wouldn't have done anything around the house either if all I got was criticism. He couldn't do anything right." Now we are all pondering the question, and I continue, "You know, Aunt Teresa once told me that while grandmother was in the hospital having Uncle Bill, he spent the whole week painting the woodwork in the kitchen. She said it came out a little reddish. Grandmother was so mad when she got home, she made him strip it back to the way it was. I remember Teresa shaking her head, saying, 'Boy, were we blue that week.' I don't think I would have done anything around the house after that either. I think of his tomatoes in a private garden beyond my grandmother's lilac bush on the other side of the hedges. Every year he put them in with high hopes, and every year, come the middle to end of August, we'd feast on them. We'd be up at Hampton Beach, the small black and white with the tin foil on the antennas, tuned into the Channel 38 for the Red Sox. On his day off, Uncle Bill would stop by the house in Winchester on his way up to the beach and pick up a bag of tomatoes. In his later years, Gunner had become a bit of a curmudgeon about them. There'd be a blight, blossom end rot, refusal to fruit, a cold snap. He'd be so disappointed. This was usually around the time the Red Sox began to tank. He'd be grumbling about how they let him down, and he'd declare he was never growing tomatoes again, but he'd plant them the next year just the same. I remember the good ones. I remember eating them like apples. I remember putting the thick slices on a tuna fish sandwich made with Miracle Whip. We'd all come up from the beach around noontime, and Teresa would put towels on the wooden chairs so we could sit with our still wet bathing suits still stuck with sand. Our feet would caress the clawfoot double pedestal legs of the table where grandmother had laid out 1 bowl of tuna with onions and 1 without. There'd be a pitcher of skim milk and a pitcher of whole. There'd be 2 plates of bread that one of us kids had run up to the corner store to get in exchange for a quarter. There'd be a mix of rye and seeded Italian, and there'd be a plate of cold cuts and a bowl of chips. My Aunt Teresa knew who ate the bread heels and who didn't, who liked onions and who preferred regular mayonnaise. And no matter the meal, there'd always be a jar of Pottsfield pickle that grandmother had made the fall before with grandfather's tomatoes. Some red ones, some green ones. The water would go on for tea and we'd pass the plates around. My aunt's old friend Rita from the neighborhood would be there at the end of the table, and my aunt Catherine, Teresa's younger sister, would be scooched in by the window, lighting a cigarette. They were all nurses and would talk shop. Teresa would be running back and forth between the kitchen and the dining room, fetching things for whoever came in. If there were unexpected guests, Teresa made room. Uncle Bill would ask everyone if they wanted tonic. Then he'd fetch the ice cubes and fill the paper cups. You labeled your cups by scratching your initials into the waxy bottom, and after lunch, you place them on the kitchen windowsill for next time. There'd be devil dogs on the credenza, teasing us, making us wait. Devil dogs and those individually packaged boxes of cereal with the perforated lines for cutting into, an all-in-one cereal bowl. When we slept there, we'd sneak down early to get the sugar pops. In my memory, for each of the 33 years I visited my grandfather there, there'd always be at least two plates of thickly sliced, juicy, sweet beefsteak tomatoes going around the table. Certain smells still place me back there at that table. A whiff of seaweed, a bowl of ripening peaches, or the faint hint of gas when the stove is lit. And suddenly I'm there at the cottage with the ocean air coming through the dining room window and Teresa putting the water on for tea. When the plate finally came around to you, you'd lift your fork and stab a half-inch slice of tomato the same size as your bread and lay it on top of the tuna fish made with Miracle Whip and onions while the kettle whistled. It was acceptable to add potato chips to the sandwich if that's what you preferred. Crunching into the onions and maybe a bit of sand, it's a ritual my siblings and I repeat in August to this day. The tomato is the crowning glory. I hate Miracle Whip, my cousin says now as we reminisce, but then reflects a bit. But I guess you're right about grandmother being so critical. I remember she complained and complained about how he needed to fix that driveway. One summer, she went to Ireland for a month with her sisters, and I said to him, wouldn't it be nice if she came home to a nice new driveway? I convinced him to do it. He worked so hard on that driveway. She came home and gave him holy hell. Another sister has come along and is listening. She concurs. You do remember what was on the wall in the kitchen at the Winchester house. She looks at me. The doghouse, I say. It was a key rack with five keychains, each shaped like a dog and labeled for each household member. Grandmother, grandfather, Teresa, Catherine, and Uncle Bill, who usually only came home on Mondays and Tuesdays on his days off from the rectory. There were five hooks, one for each dog, but to the left of that, there was an extra special hook that stood on its own inside a beautifully painted doghouse. Grandfather's keychain was always in there. We'd come over and grandmother would say, your grandfather's in the doghouse. Then she'd tell us the story of what had landed him there. We'd always take him and put him back down with the others, and every time we came back over, he'd be in there again, my sister says. Do you think he enjoyed it, this thing they had? Probably, my sister says. Yeah, I think so. Back in Winchester, in the bathroom upstairs above the kitchen, you can sit and watch the party out the window. You want to close the shade or they could see you too, but you want to watch from this perch. Maybe you've hidden things here. Maybe that candy you took from the dish and filled your pockets with. Not that they'd mind. It's just that you took so much and that you knew it was one of the main reasons you like coming here so much. Maybe you unraveled hidden things here later. Maybe you felt the guilt of who you really were, which the you in this bathroom was hiding from the you just presented in the kitchen. Maybe you didn't really go to church after all and never came to visit before noon on a Sunday so they wouldn't know. One time, you didn't bother to close the shade because nobody was out there, just grandfather's t-shirts hanging on the line. So intimate. Yet Teresa didn't mind them hanging there for all the world to see. You sat and stared at them. They meant life. The t-shirts hanging from the line meant he was still alive, that he'd be wearing them again, or maybe that he had worn them for the last time. Still, in that moment sitting there, looking out the window at those white ribbed tank t-shirts, you decide that all they meant was that he was still with us now, downstairs in that bed. They were all down there, gathered around in the sun parlor, and they were telling stories and laughing when you came in earlier. He was just there, the centerpiece, not quite conscious, sleeping maybe. They had obviously been there for a while, but this sight was new to you. You thought you had already said goodbye 6 weeks earlier when he held your newborn, whose name you hadn't quite settled on, when he told you to call him whatever you felt was right and not to listen to what anyone said, when he told you, "If he cries, you pick him up." He was 92 years your baby's senior, and at this point, he got to have an opinion. You knew at that time because Catherine had said it. "He's failing." "What?" you had answered. "He's failing." This shouldn't have come as a surprise because he had said it to you himself during the previous year. "I'm not going to be around much longer." He told you that he'd prefer to go to the doctor, not to get cured, but because he'd like to know what he was dying of. You were too inexperienced to know that this was an opening, that he was telling you something, and you shut down the conversation with something like, "Oh, don't say that. You're not going anywhere." He had expressed sadness at the loss of his close friend, that everyone was dying, but you didn't quite get it. At the end of summer, it was hard to get there so close to giving birth, but by now you knew you had to get there one last time, with him there by the salty air, with the sand in the carpet and the Red Sox on the radio and the disappointment of the tomato and baseball seasons. It was that time of year and you weren't going to miss it. And it would serve as a goodbye. It could be that. You could remember him that way. So how do you find yourself 6 weeks later in this other place, at this other house, sitting on the edge of his bed in the sun parlor with all the joking around you, the laughing, and him just sleeping through it all? You didn't want to see them this way. "Gunnar," you say, "it's me." When you say your name, his right leg jumps. He knows it is you. Maybe you didn't want to see him this way, but maybe he needed you there in that moment. You seek refuge in the upstairs bathroom, away from the laughter. They were surrounding him with loved ones, and that's how people die sometimes, surrounded by loved ones. And sometimes they die very early in the morning when no one is around. Sometimes we rush to their bedsides, and sometimes we know it's okay. They are in good hands. We have had our moment. They are okay. In his eulogy a few days later, Uncle Bill said that Gunnar's sense of humor was our inheritance. This was when you felt grateful for the laughter. About a year before he died, my grandfather told me that the day my grandmother died was the saddest day of his life. This both surprised me and did not surprise me. It surprised me not because of how she used to talk to him. It was more that she had already left us in some way many years before, when she lost her words and substituted other words that lived close in her mind, like slipper for foot, ice cream for tears. She loved ice cream so much, it was one of the last words she kept. She loved it so much that she swore at her youngest son, the priest, her pride and joy, when he told her she couldn't have any more. "You just finished your ice cream 10 minutes ago," Uncle Bill said. But she hadn't remembered. It got worse, as it does, and she went into the phase where there was no speech at all. She could still chew. Her daughters or son or whoever happened to be visiting that day got her up for every meal. They moved the table out away from the window and made room for her chair. They sat with her as they all had lunch or dinner. She took her time. They waited. She could still eat a sandwich, even without her teeth. Day in, day out, they took care of her. Sometimes on Uncle Bill's day off, he'd be there next to her, arm over her shoulder, singing softly. My nephew, then too, liked to sit next to her. The kids would come in, go for the living room, perhaps find the candy, watch TV. But he'd scooch in right up next to her and suck his thumb. Grandfather did the dishes as my aunts took her back to her bed in the sun parlor. She started sleeping more, but they kept up the routine, even when it came time to go back up to the beach for vacation. I remember Grandfather having a particularly tough day. He said out loud, "This isn't living, it's just existing." I took it in, not as a pronouncement of her condition, but as an expression of his sadness, his anger and frustration at the cruelty of it. Yet this condition went on for years, and the care did too, at home where she had raised children and grown old, the home where my grandfather had been born in 1906. Perhaps it explains my surprise when he said, just after she died, that it was the saddest day of his life. She had already died in some way, and yet she hadn't. We had come to know this other person. With Alzheimer's, it is never quite clear whether the person you knew is still in there, though sometimes there are glimpses. We used to sit out on the piazza together at the end of the day and watch the people coming down from Main Street, he said. I hadn't known about that, had never even seen the piazza used in that house. Once, when he was hospitalized for some reason, I went in to visit him. Grandmother was mostly in her bed at this point. He told me that he had a nice dream. He looked at me and said, I dreamed that Ag put her arm up. He gestured, an arm slung around an invisible shoulder. I already knew that day that he had missed the earlier Ag, but then I also learned that he'd missed the new version, too. He had already lost her, and yet... Yellow nightgown. You turn the corner and I follow, wearing your yellow nightgown. Halfway down the stairs, you pause in the morning sunlight that streams through the transom window. Forefinger up, you silently count three sneezes, and we go on our way. For you, three sneezes in the morning sun. For me, waking to the sulfur smell of the paper mill on a rainy Tuesday. When I come home, I bring you a book of photographs. American Pictures, it is called. The photographer wears a braid in his beard, chin to belly. I was inspired by the poverty depicted there to see things as they are. Why I think you'd like that, I don't know. Your mother opens the book, flips through, closes its back cover upon itself. Instant depression, she says. I thrive in the gloomy, and you seek the sunlight. I describe something incompatible to you, like mixing oil and water. No, like drinking orange juice after brushing your teeth. I love that, you say. This is called Croyer's Summer Evening. Janie sent me Croyer's Summer Evening on Skagen's southern beach. It was on a card, framed in gold. Inside it said, I miss you. Summer evening on Skagen's southern beach. It could have been any beach. It could have been Gloucester. It could have been that other Hampton, with Boar's Head on the north end, Little Woburn on the south, and all that honky-tonk in the middle. But still the ocean, the sand, the walking. She misses me many years ago. We are the women in the white dresses and the yellow ribbons and the hats. We are walking in intimate conversation. We are walking in marvel. We are walking in reverie. We are walking in deep, embarrassed, hilarious, thundering laughter. We could have been Jane and Polly, or we could have been our made-up hookup names, Randy and Rochelle. Though we'd forgot who was who when it suddenly mattered. Or we could have been the wife of a painter and his playwright lover's girlfriend. We could have been whispering. We could have been in New London, or we could have been in Denmark. But in any case, on any beach, in any country, it would still be true that when the wives of two lover artists go strolling the beach after summer dressed like that, the joke is on them.
Thank you so much. Suzanne's chapbook, Ag and Gunner, is available on the Gallery of Readers website, so come visit us online. And if you can, share a little abundance because we are a nonprofit and exist through this community. We would love to see you at a reading or hear about a book you're enjoying right now. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back soon with another local author. Until then.